Now we're resuming the tale about our trip to Africa. We spent about a week in the Gambia.
Thank you for tuning in to Hannah and Eric Go Birding, a podcast by birders for birders.
I'm Hannah and he's Eric.
We created this podcast to share adventures, sometimes misadventures, and opinions that we have on different birding topics. We're definitely not experts, and anything that we discuss that might be controversial. Once you remember, there are own opinions, and they might be different from yours.
So the Great Backyard Bird Count is coming up.
Yeah, it's just like 2 weeks out, right?
Ish. Yeah, a little bit more than 2 weeks. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology, in partnership with a lot of other organizations, hosts the Great Backyard Bird Count. And it's another one of those opportunities for us to go out and explore birds in our yards that will help, you know, create more of a snapshot of what's happening at any given time in the world with birds.
Yeah, for us it's super easy with our backyard. We can just look out of our back window and see our entire backyard.
Yeah.
It's nice having a little tiny backyard.
Sometimes. Yeah. And if you don't have a backyard, or if you want to explore somewhere else other than your backyard, there's a lot of events going on, and we'll post a link in the show notes for that information. So if you want to join in an event during the weekend that it occurs, February 16th through the 19th, you can check that out and learn more about it also at that website if you have questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So also, we wanted to thank some folks for buying us a coffee.
Yeah, someone.
Someone.
Someone bought us a coffee.
Yes.
And we appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, someone. And thank you to everyone else that has bought us a coffee, which helps support our show and the stuff that we do. If you would like to participate in that, you can go to our website, which is www.gobirdingpodcast.com, and find out about how to buy us a coffee or other affiliate programs that we've joined.
Yeah. Okay, so Hannah's got two other podcasts.
I do.
Yeah, so Women Birders Happy Hour and Bird Nerd Book Club. We have last week, Women Birders Happy Hour's episode was with who?
With Laura Zahn. And the drink for that episode was an Eastern Screech Owl.
Ooh, Eastern Screech Owl.
Yeah, it's very delicious. Yeah. So check that out anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Yeah. And then next week?
Next week is my Bird Nerd Book Club episode, out with Susan Myers, whose book, The Bird Name Book, came out in 2022. And that episode will come out in February on the 2nd.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited about listening to this one. The book's all about the etymology of like all sorts of different bird names across the entire world. Simple things like piha and stuff like that, like not simple, quote unquote simple, but then also where some of the eponyms came from. So it's really, really interesting where everything, kind of a backstory about random words that are bird associated. Bird
related words, yeah. And it was really fun to chat with her about it because I learned so much about where some of these names do come from. Mm-hmm. And they're not so much the eponyms. They're mostly like, you know, thrush and wren and stuff like
that.
Yeah. And just the amount of time and effort that it took her to collect all this and then research it all. It was just a huge undertaking that I am so, like, amazed that she undertook.
It's a pretty big book too.
Yeah,
it's a full-size book,
and it's a reference guide, really. Yeah. It's not so much like a sit down and read novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's more something that if you have a question about like a bird name, you can just like flip to whatever the bird name is, and then, you know, you'll have an answer there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So our upcoming travel, we're doing some of that. San Diego Bird Festival is in February, so we'll be there leading biking and birding, as well as speaking and then doing a party at the end.
A party!
We're going to Spring Chirp in the Rio Grande Valley, April 17th through the 20th. That is going to be super fun. It's a boutique festival, so it's great to, you know, really have intimate connection with birders at that festival, so I'm looking forward to that. We just added something to our schedule.
As of yesterday, we added it to the schedule.
Yeah, so one of our friends suggested going on this cruise that's a repositioning cruise, and I've heard other birders going on it, and the more I looked into it, more and more birders are going on this specific cruise. It's a princess cruise on May 7th through the 11th from Los Angeles to Vancouver, Canada, and it is a great way to see a number of seabirds that you might not see otherwise.
Yeah, so for cruises like this, there are a couple of companies. Oregon Pelagic Tours is running a tour where you can hire Tim Shelmerdine and Russ Nametz. to guide you while you're on the cruise, help you figure out things. I don't remember what the price is on that, but I know it's on their website. I think we'll probably include that in the show notes. There's also a couple other larger tour companies that are offering guided trips for this specific cruise. We're just going on the cruise just to go with our friends and look for pelagics at the same time. And if for anybody that doesn't know, it is a thing to go on repositioning cruises, especially on the West Coast, because of the distance that they travel up the coast is just far enough out that you can get pelagic species on it. And it's not so far out that you start losing that ability. So it's really interesting. I know for a number of years, Oregon Pelagic Tours has been running a trip, maybe not this exact cruise, but a very similar cruise to it. So I'm really looking forward to it. So May 7th to 11th, Princess Cruise Line, LA to Vancouver,
Canada. Yeah. And not that we're guiding at all it, but
we're just going.
Well, and you know,
found a cheap inside room.
Exactly. And you know, part of our podcast is that we wanted to share some of these, like, I hesitate to say insider because it's like not really insider, but if you're not aware of it, you're not aware of it. You know,
just another thing to bird.
Yeah, exactly. These kind of opportunities. So, yeah, we're not guiding, but if you want to go on a fun repositioning cruise with some other birders, then this might be an interesting opportunity for you.
I'm thinking we're probably doing the math. There's probably at least 40 other birders so far.
Yeah.
That are going on this cruise, and there's still quite a few rooms left. But
yeah, that'd be interesting.
Not that we're making any money off of it at all. It would be nice to fill it up like Flock to Marion. Like, fill up the cruise full of birders.
That would be pretty cool.
And then all the bars can be empty every evening because we're all getting up at 4 a.m. to go out on the deck.
I'm going to be hanging out in the bars.
Bars and 4 a.m. Okay.
Yeah. I see.
No sleep.
No sleep club. And then lastly, the travel that we have currently, I am going to the Amazon Birding Expedition Brazil for women, mm-hmm. which we did talk about in our last episode a little bit.
Yeah. Maeda gave us a little bit of insight about her company and what's going down.
Yeah. And then Eric will try to figure out some other way to hitch a ride to Brazil.
Yeah.
So looking forward to that. And, absolutely. We'll put that information in the show notes as well as if you want to join me in the Amazon.
Yeah. So speaking of Brazil and Amazon and birding and all of that sentence, Maeda has offered up graciously to give us our January Bird Nerd giveaway. And results are in. We have a winner for our January Bird Nerd giveaway. What they had to do, everyone that entered told us where they want to go in 2024, either revisit or a place that they have never been before is kind of a travel destination that they're really hoping to go, backyard, wherever. And who was it? Who won, Hannah? Who did we pick?
So our randomly selected winner to win a $200 gift certificate towards a Birding is the World Brazil trip is Nate, who wants to travel to Iguazu Falls on the Argentine-Brazil border, which I would love to go there as well. That sounds like an amazing place. But congratulations, Nate. We'll get in touch about how to get you your gift certificate. And thank you to everyone else who participated. And, you know, tune into our next episode in February for our next giveaway.
Yeah, find out what you can win next month. Okay, so quick recap. We just got back from Africa.
Yeah.
Two episodes ago, we talked all about Senegal. We spent 2 weeks, basically, down in Western Africa. Mm-hmm. 1 week in Senegal, 1 week in Gambia. Our first episode, we split this. Our first episode is all about Senegal. Today, we are talking all about the Gambia.
However,
yes,
there
is a caveat right now.
Yeah, so after we posted the episode and everything, and I was looking back on my experience in Africa, I remembered an experience that we forgot to relate to you all, which
was fascinating and weird and interesting and felt like a video game.
Thought I was going to die. And it was when we were at Juj National Park, we were looking for the Arabian bustard.
Yeah, which is in the northern part of Senegal, if you don't remember from our discussion last episode.
Right on the Mauritania border. Mm-hmm. And we were looking for the Arabian bustard, and to do that, we were going, there's only like 6 Arabian bustards in this park, mm-hmm. and you know, it's a whole thing to go out and go look for them. I was looking through eBird records, and there's not a whole lot of them. And I only, like, it was amazing to look through because it's like, I knew one of the people who had seen them.
Yeah.
Which is so funny to look through eBird records and find names that you know. Anyways, so we're along the bank of the big lake that's out there in Juge. Mm-hmm. And there's these tall grasses, maybe like, I don't know, like chest high for me.
Yeah, it's grasses. Like rushes, like just full of rushes. They're pokey and they're tall and hard.
Yeah.
And but chest high, and chest to stomach high.
And the ground was really uneven. It's mm-hmm. like it had been muddy at one point in time, and then like a whole herd of cows had come stomping through it. And so it was hard to walk through.
Yeah.
Because you're getting smacked in the chest with these rushes and then
stabbed in the thighs and stabbed in the stomach and whole experience out there.
Yeah. And so as Eric and I were walking, well, and our guides were walking through the first field of whatever this is, the rushes, to look for the Arabian bustard, to hope that it'll flush out if mm-hmm. we step close enough to it. Like, all of a sudden, I stepped in one place, and then, like, a speeding cannon, like, shot away from me.
Yeah.
And I was like, what was that? Like, it just took me, like, I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience because I almost died
yeah.
from this thing running into me.
And but it didn't run into you. It ran away from you.
It did. It ran away from me. But it was a warthog. They hide in these, well, I mean,
well, they're not they're hiding. Foraging. They're sleeping. And we're coming upon them as they're napping or sleeping, or sometimes they're foraging, but it's just, they're just minding their own business, and they can't see us from yeah. the distance, and they can't really hear us because there's just so much stuff. But as soon as we get within 5 to 10 feet, they panic and they're like, huh! And they take off running.
Yeah.
Cause they're like, oh, I don't want to get eaten.
It was basically like when you're playing a video game and you hit the aggro of whatever, like, the thing is that's trying to kill you. Like, if you're Mario mm-hmm. and you're racing around and you get too close to, I don't know, those, like, ducks.
The Goombas or the...
Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all of a sudden they, like, race towards you. It was like that. It was kind of... It was terrifying. I know it wasn't going to hurt me. Like, our guides were like, no, it's fine. You know, that's what they do. But still.
Yeah, they assured us that this time of year, there are no babies. And when they have babies is when they are dangerous.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. But it was still shocking every single time as we're walking, we get like within 10 feet and then they go taking off and it would like rustle up all the stuff. But we never actually saw the warthog. So I don't even know. Maybe it wasn't warthogs. Who knows what it was? Maybe it was graboids or something underground.
I have no idea,
but it was, he assured us they were warthogs. They were running away from us. But yeah, I was walking through these chest-high rushes that you couldn't see anything, and then having things run away from you.
Yeah.
Like, gallop away, like, pretty heavily.
That was one of those moments, like, I was terrified at the time, and now I look back on it, and it's, like, so weird. So weird that that happened to me.
I would have liked to see, like, a aerial view of us walking through that. Like, yeah. the four of us walking, like... Each of us only, like, we're, like, 20 feet apart or so, walking in a line, or 30, 40, something like that apart, walking in a line, and, like, an aerial view of just, like, these pockmarked little sections where there was a warthog just napping or whatever, and then all of a sudden it just takes off running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Interesting. Anyways, so that was way back in Senegal.
Yeah, so now we're getting into Gambia.
Yes, now we're 5 days later, suddenly. Boom.
So on the way out of Senegal into Gambia, we stopped in a couple locations along the highway because we were seeing birds like along the highway mm-hmm. and there was a spot with an owl. So we had to go stop and look for the Varouz owl that was stationed right near the road. And then Eric spotted a couple of Bruce's green pigeons.
Yes.
There as well. So that was really good. Last birds.
It was
for
our
Senegal.
Last Senegal lifer, bird number 200 for Senegal. So that was pretty cool. I think we ended up getting like one more species after that in Senegal, but I don't know. Bird number 200. It was pretty exciting. I got a really awful picture of some Bruce's green pigeons.
So yeah, it was really good to get that last lifer on the way out of Senegal.
Yeah, a really interesting bird. Green, blue, grayish, blue grayish, like weird, not real colors. Like it looks like somebody used a crayon to color this bird in. So it's like very uniformly,
boom. Yeah,
just not natural looking, I guess.
It's not how I use crayons. So anyways, we dropped Muhammad off at a village near the side of the road where he had family. And so mm-hmm. he was going to spend some time with them, but it was
yeah, before heading back up to Juge where that's where his full-time home is.
Yeah. So it was great having him with us and very fun to meet him. And then we got to the Senegal-Gambia border, which ended up being a huge traffic jam.
Oh my gosh. It was It seemed like the most confusing thing. If you didn't speak French or Wolof, like, it would have been a nightmare. And it kind of was a nightmare anyways. even with our guide who did speak Wolof just fine. But we got our stamps to leave Senegal there and then got in line to leave. And then the police were just blocking the road.
Yeah.
Like, they were only letting people into Senegal, not out of Senegal for some reason. Like, they... And not like on purpose, like it was a blockade. It was just the road was congested and they, for whatever reason, were not letting the traffic go from the other direction. So we were just sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting. It was well over an hour.
However, we finally got through and we headed off towards our hotel for the night, but had a couple stops along the way. One was just kind of a random peanut farm to look for Temex Courser.
Yeah. And I think the reason we stopped really at the peanut farm, the Temex Courser was an intended target there, but also Abrima, I had already asked like 20 or 30 questions about processing peanuts. And because we've been seeing peanut farms the whole time. Like I was like, so I've been watching them as they process them, the shaking the dust out and drying them and all that stuff. So then I think he was like, oh, well, this peanut farm has somebody currently working on it. Let's go talk to him.
I gotta feel so bad for every single guide that's ever had us because we must ask the most random weird questions that are like totally irrelevant to birds and birding.
Yeah. Just, I'm really curious about how they process peanuts out there in the middle of nowhere with nothing.
So. I know. I just, like, we just ask these random things. Like, tell me all about the history of processing peanuts. But no, I totally get it.
When we're guiding in the Rio Grande, like, that's very similar things happen. People just ask the most random questions. And you got to be on your game. You got to know.
You never
know. Or at least know a little bit about so much stuff to be able to guide. Because people are going to ask the most random things about... What's that pipe over there? What does that do?
You never know what you're going
to
expect.
You never know. And I'm going to ask those questions. I'm going to be sure to repay the favor.
Especially as it comes to, like, infrastructure and, like, equipment. You're just going to ask those questions and they're like, I don't know.
Like, how long has that piece of equipment been in use? What's the history on that?
Yeah. So, back on course. So, we stopped at this peanut farm to... look for the courser and try some fresh peanuts from the farmer, which was very cool that, you know, he stopped and talked to us for a few minutes about, you know, farming peanuts and all that. In Gambia and Senegal, they have a lot more similarity to like the way land is used in like Europe, that there's the right to roam sort of mentality. So you can just walk on people's farms.
Yeah. And as long as you're not damaging stuff, it's basically like, don't be a jerk. But you can go wherever. Unlike in the United States, where if you start walking on somebody's farm, even if it's a fallow field, like you're probably going to have a gun pulled on you.
Yeah.
But over there, it was pretty much just kind of wander around. Land is land. You walking through a fallow field isn't going to hurt it in any way. It's just you wandering around. So.
Yeah. So the guy gave us a few peanuts to try, some fresh peanuts, like, right out of the field, and they were great.
They tasted like peanuts.
Yeah.
They tasted like unsalted peanuts.
Yeah, basically. So we got back towards the car, and there was a grasshopper buzzard that flew over, which was our first lifer back into Gambia. Yeah.
And it was a great view of this buzzard. He moved from pole to pole to pole as we drove along, and then finally... Like, we were just driving, not quite highway speed, but just kind of, like, cruising along, looking for other stuff. And then by the time we decided, I was like, hey, do you mind if I get out and take a picture of this guy? It had gotten more and more brave as it flew from pole to pole until finally we were, like, almost right underneath the pole.
Yeah.
And then I got out of the car and it just, like, it, like, looked at me and then it was like, well, I guess I'll fly away. And then it kind of flew away. So I got some nice shots of it flying away right off the pole.
Yeah, so then we got to our accommodation, which is Morgan Kunda, which is becoming a more and more known birding lodge in northern Gambia, which is the intention for that site. The lodge itself is built by a European who started a nonprofit to come down to this village and create this lodge to help, you know, create some sort of monetary income for the village. And, you know, there was signage in the room about how a lot of these folks come from villages with no electricity and no water, and they're trying to be the bird destination so they can, like I said, infiltrate some more income into mm-hmm. that community. Which everyone there was just super nice. Everybody in the village was like so excited to see us. I mean, we were like celebrities driving through, which I mean, they kept yelling at Tuba, Tuba at us, which I think we mentioned in the last episode kind of translates to white people.
To white people, yeah.
So
it's like when you're going through Mexico and people would yell gringo, like that sort of thing where it's, I don't think the kids are intentionally being disrespectful, but it's just like, just yelling. Just like, they're noticing that you're a white person and they're like, oh, you're a white person, white person, white person.
Yeah. So anyways, it's right across from the school too for that community. So there's a lot of kids coming and going.
Oh yeah.
But it's a beautiful lodge. There's, I don't know, maybe 10 rooms or so, that, you know, have your own private bathroom and a couple, twin beds and, restaurant, well, you know, kind of the dining area in the middle.
Yeah, big open gazebo with the you dine at, and it has there was electricity, no AC, but they had fans. And then there was which I thought the most interesting part of that whole lodge, or not the most interesting, but a really interesting thing about it is in that gazebo area there was a little refrigerator that was self-service drinks and pay like honor box payment. So it was like there was beer and juices and water and stuff like that in the little refrigerator, and it was kind of nice. It was like, oh, if I want a beer anytime, I don't have to like take someone out of their way and go get it. I just go and grab a beer out of the fridge and toss 100
Delassi.
Yeah, 100 Delassi up in the, or maybe it was only 70 Delassi. I don't know, but it was whatever the dollar amount was. You just toss the Delassi up in the basket and grab a beer.
Well, they also had a couple of juices that we weren't brave enough to try that were like freshly pressed and like, but they were like in, you know, 2-liter bottles from like, I don't know, whatever soda, like Coke bottles. So we weren't brave enough to try them, but they had like Baobab juice.
So they didn't have Baobab. They had it listed. And that's the one I wanted to try, but there wasn't any in the refrigerator.
I can't remember what the other two
were. The Dutch guy ended up drinking the last one. And was like, oh, man, I wanted to try that, man. But
give me a sip.
I never got a chance to try the Baobab juice.
Anyways, so the lodge itself, they have kind of a garden area that they were working on as we were there. But that was just such a good little birding spot, too. You know, they had a water trough, and so that was like the hottest part of the day when we just got there. And so a lot of things were coming to the water, but tons of quailias, lots of different waxbill species.
And the cutthroat.
Yeah.
Cutthroat. I was standing there. I got a bunch of photos of the cutthroat, and then it's a cutthroat finch, is what our guide is referring to it. But I think, Eber just refers to it as just cutthroat with no additional names to it.
And I'm so mad because that was like the one bird that I wanted to get a good video of through digiscoping. And I didn't bring my scope because it was like, what am I going to see just around
the... We're at the lodge. We're not really walking anywhere.
Yeah. And then I went back to go get my scope, and by the time I did, it was gone. But Eric
hang out for a long time though.
Eric got some beautiful photos of it in the bougainvillea. Yeah. So it's just, you know, got the bright flowers and then the cutthroat there.
If you're not familiar with cutthroat, it's kind of one of those species that pops up on like National Geographic and like things occasionally. Like you see this bird and like Life of Birds and stuff like that. It's just like this finch that has like this blood red slash across its throat of feathers. So it looks like it's just been murdered by somebody.
Yeah.
But it's just like this big across its throat. It's really, really fascinating looking finch. Otherwise, it's really kind of just gray and speckly overall. But that bright red throat just sticks out and is really interesting looking.
So after it kind of cooled off a little bit, we headed off to a set of wetlands that wasn't too far away from the lodge. That was like further west
just
of
west
there.
Just west of it, yeah.
And that was fantastic birding there. We had Senegal thick knees. We had lapwings along that dike going out there, reef herons. And then when we got out to it, there was a couple of sand grouse that flew away right as we pulled up. And so we got out in the field and wandered around the field and nothing.
It's one of those situations that is like the most frustrating birding situation. You're walking along, you saw where the bird landed, and you're like, oh, if I walk, I think it looked like it landed in a clearing. I think if I go walk over this direction, I can get a look into that clearing and see it. So we walked that way. Nothing. See nothing in the clearing. So then we walk past it. We're like, well, maybe it walked and it continued walking east and we didn't see it. So we keep going, kind of wander around, keep going, like wandered all over the place. And then finally, as we're going back to the van, we go back past that clearing and they flush from the middle of that clearing. They were there the whole time. We walked past them twice and they didn't do it. And then they flush. And it's like, are you kidding me? They were here the whole time. And that birds blend in.
Yeah.
They do a good job of what they need to do, blending in.
Yeah, so that was frustrating. But then we kept on going in, and we got to a forest that had some fantastic stuff as well. And Abrima is, our guide, is a fantastic, it's not really pishing. He just was whistling the owl call.
The owlet call, the pearl-spotted owlet call?
Yeah, which gets everything going. And so, like, we were just in the middle of, like, a grove of trees, and mm-hmm. he was doing that whistle, and so many things were coming just in, like cordon blues, Namaqua doves, even kingfisher was calling back at him, the bee eaters, tinkerbird. That was really great birding right in there. And then we went a little further.
Well, we
and
even
got our got one of our goals for the day, which is a sahel paradise wida.
Yeah, so super super long tail. It's these widas are, they're so weird. They don't, It's very clearly a secondary sexual characteristic for the males mm-hmm. to develop to be attractive to the females, and it's obviously not for survival. They have these tails, both these guys and the exclamatory widas, they have these tails that are just so long that while they're flying, it's obviously a struggle to fly, mm-hmm. and they're dragging that tail through the air as like this massive inconvenience. But for whatever reason, it's become like attractive to the females that this is their show of virulence, that they are really good at what they do.
Oh, you don't see it?
I don't see it. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Interesting.
But they're fascinating birds, and we had a couple of them flying around, which is just like this weird floppy flight of these tails dragging through the air.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple species like that, like the widow birds down in, yeah. in South Africa that have that crazy long tail like that.
That's just like not...
They're not great flyers with it.
Not survival. Not a survival adaptation. It is a different adaptation.
Yeah. So the sun started to go down, and we headed back to the car and back to the lodge. Mm-hmm. Had a great dinner. Had a little conversation with the guy that was staying next to us, who's mm-hmm. from Belgium. And, you know, I think we might have mentioned this in the Senegal episode, but we're interested in tourism and why people like tour in certain places. And I don't know, we talk about it a lot between yeah. ourselves.
And we also ask people, especially when we go places like Senegal and Gambia, where we've never been here. We've never been someplace.
We don't really know anybody that's part of the world.
We don't know anybody that's been here. So pretty much every single person that we ran into that spoke English really well, is usually the Europeans, Belgians, Dutch, British, that were coming down. We asked them, why are you here? Why did you come to Senegal? Or why did you come to the Gambia? And so we were like, oh, well, we'll have a couple of beers with this gentleman from Belgium and ask him, why? Why are you here? What about Gambia drew you to come to Gambia?
This is like another one of those set of questions. It's like, nobody's ever going to want to go anywhere with us because we ask all these questions all the time.
Well, it's like your sister was asking everyone for a couple of years, what did you have for lunch growing up? Like, what did you do about lunch for school? Like,
well,
did you make it at home? Did you go to school and have it? What was the deal?
When we were just on our trip with her, she was telling me that she likes to ask people who English isn't their first language what their first language was, mm-hmm. because she's a
their first foreign language.
I can't remember. Okay. But because she's a language teacher, mm-hmm. you know, it's like how we ask tourism questions, because that's like what's constantly going in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
So everybody's probably got their own questions that's that they true. Ask.
Everyone's probably asking some type of question.
That's not too weird.
No.
Anyways,
no. This is just our question.
So we were like grilling this guy about like, why did you come here?
Why?
And we were trying to figure out like, is coming to Gambia and Senegal, like going to Costa Rica for an American, you know, for Europeans to go there, because it's a short flight.
It's a single easy flight that you don't have to make any transfers, especially if you come from Belgium.
Time zone, essentially.
I think you're one time zone difference. Maybe. So you're 1 hour difference from most of Europe. So it's not really that different from, like, you're just going straight south. And it's a simple non-transfer flight. You just hop on Amsterdam, London, and Belgium. All three have direct flights straight there. So you have three different options to be able to get to either Senegal or Gambia.
Yeah.
So relatively easy flight, short.
Well, and, you know, they were, Gambia was colonized by the British, and Senegal was colonized by the French. Mm-hmm. And so there's a long history and relationship there between those countries. So, yeah, anyways, we were trying to figure it out. And his comment was kind of interesting, that he was thinking that Costa Rica was a lot more developed in terms of tourism. And so, like, you have to stay on a trail. And he liked Senegal and Gambia because he could just bushwhack.
Yeah. Which felt like it was like a false impression that he either had or was a different idea that he had in his head, because everywhere we went that seemed like we were off the trail or we were off in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, 5 minutes later, a goat herd would walk past.
Yeah. A goat herd would walk past with like 11 teenagers that are taking care of this goat herd.
Yeah.
Or it's not undiscovered, unexplored areas. We're walking through farm fields. Even if we were in seemingly middle of nowhere, we were still walking through some sort of development. It wasn't development to the same level as a city or the same level as like trails in Costa Rica or Colombia, where it's very clearly you have distinction, but there was some sort of development.
Well, in a lot of Colombia, like when we were down there, we were burning along the road and there was like undeveloped forest like adjacent to us, but we weren't going into the forest.
Yeah. We were staying on the road, because road breaks were where birds are going to be crossing.
Yeah.
Easier to. So it was just interesting that's what he valued, is someplace that felt or either was or felt like it was unexplored and undeveloped. And it had me thinking while talking to him about like the level of tourism. So if you go to a place that doesn't have very much tourism, it's probably okay for there not to be developed trails and for people to just go wherever they want to go and just kind of meander through a habitat. And it's probably better for the habitat if it has very low levels of tourism. It's probably better for the habitat to not cut a trail through and develop it with a boardwalk or some sort of developed trail. But at a certain level of tourism, at a certain level of visitation to an area, it becomes a necessity to develop that in order to protect the areas, to protect the rest of the area.
Mm-hmm.
That you can develop a trail like that either cuts through the middle of it or goes around the edge of a section of habitat, that people then stay on that trail and they concentrate their destruction essentially to just the trail.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the habitat can remain untouched. Like there's a break point at a certain point where creating that level of destruction of building a boardwalk or cutting a trail becomes more beneficial than just letting it stay natural and letting people wander through it. It was making me think the whole time when he was talking about it, like there is a break point at a certain point where you have to develop, otherwise you're going to destroy what habitat you have by people just randomly meandering through.
And I'm sure there's research on that we can look into to like see if that's actually the case.
Yeah.
And the whole time we were talking to him, I was thinking like, I'd rather be on a trail, because then I'm, you know, not going to fall into a pit, because there were places that we were walking that were uneven and difficult to walk in.
Yeah.
Also, you know, then I'm not going to be potentially trampling through an area that's sensitive
species of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that place, you know, if there's a trail that's cut through, this kind of relates to what you're saying, is that then there's like people who have been there and, you know, there's something to see in that space versus a place that, you know, we're just trampling through and we didn't see anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I feel like almost six one and a half a dozen the other, but it kind of, in my mind,
and
it's the level of tourism.
And I know you like to bushwhack.
Oh, I like to bushwhack too. Yeah.
I don't really enjoy that.
But it's,
getting smacked in the face with branches the whole time, just and like spider webs, just like, oh my gosh, like I get tired of it real quick.
But it's, I think it all comes down to the level of visitation that a particular site has. Like if it's to the level that's high enough that people are going to be damaging the habitat by walking through it, it definitely in my mind would better serve to have a trail. But this is just thoughts that I was having while we were talking to this gentleman from Belgium that had a preference for going places that were less visited and didn't have developed trails and didn't have developed stuff around it.
Yeah. Anyways. Back to birding in the Gambia. The next day, had breakfast, got out, went to some villages in the nearby community. So we went to an oasis of a, you know, little water body.
It was like just straight south out of Morgan Kunda. It's like I thought we only drove through one village. I thought it was like on the other side of the village, but there was like three villages that we drove past. I didn't realize like that they segregated the villages. Like they were touching. The villages were all, I thought it was just one village, but it was three separate small villages together.
Yeah, it was all kind of like a metro area, you know, like in Portland Metro. Tigard and Tualatin are butted up against
each other. Yeah. So we drove through a couple of the villages, and then just south of the last one is where the ag fields out of Iliasa, I think was the name of the village.
Yeah, so we found that oasis, not much going on at that point, and so we started bushwhacking through, and, you know, at first it was kind of getting slow, and the habitat was really interesting because it was, I mean, dry, obviously, but a lot more rocky, and, I mean, I don't really know how to describe it other than, like, rocky and scrubby.
Yeah, it was, like, slightly different. So what we had been seeing previously was mostly sandy, dusty, with a little bit of, like, clay sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
This was, it was still sandy and dusty, but it was also, like a volcanic rock.
But not, like, the real jagged volcanic rocks, but, you know, big, like, smooth.
Kind of smooth, yeah. It was just more rocky habitat.
Yeah. But yeah, we weren't seeing a whole lot. We had some helmeted guinea fowl and double spurred spur fowl, pigeons and doves flying around. At a couple points I was getting chased by tsetse flies, so I wasn't real happy about that. But then right when I was hitting my limit of bushwhacking through, we saw up in the tree a brown-back woodpecker, which was a great view of that. And
yes,
glad I did bring the scope, because at that point I was like, why am I carrying this thing? But that was a really good look at that.
Yeah, and then this really interesting named bird that I think is named after after the noise that it makes. I'm not sure, but a flappet lark. Took off flying, and it did I think it's a territorial display, but as it's flying up, it claps its wings both on the, I think it's doing both claps on the upswing and the downswing of its wings, and it's just like flap, 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 and it's, as it's doing it, going higher and higher and higher as it's flapping its flappeting its lark wings. So flap at lark, there we go. It names itself. But it was really, really interesting watching this thing, and mostly listening to this thing fly above our heads as it got higher and higher and higher.
Yeah, and then we got back to the oasis, which was the perfect time because that's when everything came in to get water.
Oh, and so many bee eaters.
So yeah, tons of bee eaters. There was an exclamatory, that was where we got the exclamatory paradise wide up. Yeah. And then a couple black kites and harrier hawks were coming in too. Eric spent a long time trying to get some the mottled spine tails.
Yeah, it's a little swift bird that has some mottling across its chest and a white rump. But I was like, I know I'm going to be able to get this. I know I'm going to get it. I think I took 1,000 photos, 1,000 blurry photos, at least 1,000 blurry photos of like water that was blurry and then birds that were blurry and everything. It was just like, I know I can get this, and I don't think I got it. 1,000 photos and like an hour of just like and nothing. Yeah, I'll get better someday.
Yeah,
or not,
you know. It's okay.
So we headed from there, we went south a little bit further, not much was there, so we decided, you know, let's head back. It was starting to get warm, starting to get time for like lunch-ish time.
We headed off towards the east up the river.
So the whole idea for the trip was come in on the north side of the river and then go all the way up to Janjanburra or Georgetown, and then cross the river and then come back on the south side of the river back to Banjul. So we this is when we started actually making our way upriver, trying to go towards Georgetown. And there was a really good stop that Abrima knew that was halfway to Georgetown, basically, from our entrance into Gambia.
Yeah, so the goal there was to look for Egyptian plovers, mm-hmm. which are there during migration. And we were very fortunate to be there right at that time
yes.
that they were there. So we had about 7 Egyptian plovers, which you have to Google this bird. Look at it. It is absolutely gorgeous.
Fantastic looking bird.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily like act like a plover, I wouldn't say, because it's real like kind of skittish.
Yeah, it acts more like a shorebird, like a killdeer.
Yeah.
Not like a plover. It's called plover, and I don't... The bill's, like, too big for a plover. It's a really weird... I think it's monotypic. It's not in a family with any of the other shorebirds, but it's just really weird looking in terms of, like, the plumage and the shape and its behavior. None of it matches with any of the species that are listed around it taxonomically.
Anyways, it's gorgeous. It has a gray back. It has like black through its eye and down around its neck. And then its neck and breast are like a beautiful peach color. Mm-hmm. It's such a cool bird. And I am so glad that we got the chance to see it. You know, Abrima really played it up like, oh, I hope it's there. But the reservoir was great besides that. I mean, the plovers were great, but African jacana, you know. The hornbills were everywhere, mm-hmm. red-throated bee eaters, broad-billed rollers.
Some really high white storks flying around, some pelicans flying around super high. Like a really good list at this location.
Yeah, so then we continued up the river and we got to a lodge where we were going to have lunch mm-hmm. and also just kind of avoid the hottest part of the day. And then Abrima gave us the option of whether we wanted to do the boat ride that everybody else was there to do, and we're kind of on the fence about it, and because he was like, well, you know, you go to see like hippos and chimps, and I was thinking like, oh, I haven't seen a hippo in a while. Like that kind of sounds fun.
And so. we came all the way to Africa. We might as well do everything we can to see all the things we can. We're here. So we decided, we were like, yes, let's do it. We're here. We're going to do it. And interestingly enough, both the Dutch gentleman and the Belgian gentleman that we had been leapfrogging for the last couple of days were both there and just took the same boat ride with us. So we're all going the same route. They ended up staying at that lodge, but we didn't stay at that lodge with them. We moved on to another lodge. But that boat ride was fascinating. We went out in the river, relatively large, but I'm thinking like 50 feet long or so, maybe 40 feet long. It could fit like 15 people, and there was only like 8 of us on it. So it was like a really nicely spaced out boat. Went up and down the river a little bit, and there are a number of islands that are in the middle of the River Gambia there that they are reintroducing chimps to the island. And chimps, they swim okay, but they don't swim great, so they generally just stay on the island. And they eat stuff that's growing on the island, and then the people that are doing the rehab and the reintroduction program, they go out there and feed them occasionally. And so the chimps know the sounds of the boats that are the feeding boats, and so when those boats go by, they all come out to the edge. If the other boats go by, they stay hidden inside the middle of the island, because there's no point in coming out if there's no food. So we ended up seeing some, because one of the boats that was there was one of the boats that normally feeds, so it has the motor sounds a certain way, so they came out and looked, and they were like, oh, nothing, okay, so then they went back into the forest. But then we also saw a bunch of hippos. So hippos, chimps, all in the middle of this, in this river. And so we got all of the target species, essentially. They were mammals this time, not birds. But we got the target species. So we headed back to the lodge and got back on the road, headed to Georgetown, which is our technically our river crossing to get across the river. So we get to Georgetown. There's a ferry on the north side. And Georgetown itself is on an island, and then there's a bridge that crosses the other side of the river on the south side of Georgetown. It is a very busy ferry. Like, it was packed. We ended up waiting, like, 3 cycles of the ferry before we could get on.
Mm-hmm.
Full, and they cram these ferries, Like, it was just like the ferry back, way back two episodes ago when we were talking, crossing at the mouth of the river down out of Banjul.
Yeah.
They cram these ferries full of, like, first they load the biggest vehicles, then the medium vehicles squeeze in, then the motorcycles, and then the people filter in.
Yeah.
And so they did that again this time, but we ended up with a, like, a semi-truck or a box truck. It was a very large vehicle that crammed in with us, and they had to go diagonal to fit in there, and he's like... like driving up onto the side of the boat, and it was like a whole situation where Brima's looking back and he's like, that guy's gonna sink us, because it was like so off balance, and he's like driving up onto the side of the ferry trying to get his vehicle to fit onto the ferry. It was interesting.
Yeah. So then we drove through Georgetown and got to our lodge, which mm-hmm. is the Riverside Lodge, and it seems fairly new, and they're still building some units for it, but yeah,
completely off grid lodge.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, a really nice lodge on the river. That night we heard African Scops Owl that was right above our dining room, and then we like chased it around and we were able to see it.
We got some photos, got some audio, and it was kind of nice watching it. And then as soon as we got pictures and stuff, it was like, okay, let's turn off our flashlights and let this guy live its life.
Yeah.
Like it comes every night and just hangs out. So it wasn't even a situation where we're standing outside like playing callback or whistling or anything. It just came up and started whistling.
Yeah.
So it was really, really kind of cool.
Yeah. So then the next morning, woke up, had yellow fronted bulbuls at breakfast, had a violet Tarraco that was hanging around. So we got some really good looks at that, and bearded barbits also. And then we headed over to Kunkilling Forest, where Abrima knows a population of Atamamwa turtle doves. And so that was kind of our target for that area. Of course, that is also a place for tsetse flies.
It is also the world's population of tsetse flies are in this forest, apparently. Though is really fascinating to me. It was fascinating that tsetse flies the temperature needs to get up to a certain temperature for them to become active. And so when you go out first thing in the morning and you're running around right when the birds start to become active, it's early enough and cool enough that the flies are nowhere. So we walked the trail all the way out. We saw the doves. And then we kind of meandered our way back, and right when we got back is when the flies, it had gotten warm enough, and then there was flies everywhere, and they were just getting more and more, and it was like, okay, and so we get into the van, we slam the doors, and then we're like using our hats and rags to like beat these flies, like try to get them out of the van, and
they're basically like horse flies.
Basically, yeah, they
just can carry African sleeping sickness.
Yeah, they well, just like any biting insect, they can carry a disease of some sort, and this one happens to be one that's terrifying for Americans, because we've seen documentaries growing up like about how it's horrible and all that stuff, but it's a really relatively low frequency.
But they also have it was like a 300-day like potential period where can develop symptoms.
Yeah, incubation period for the disease.
So
yeah.
Next year, we'll see.
we've got a year to find out.
Yeah,
but they're like horse flies, and the percent that they carry the disease is relatively low, and most people that get it don't get it from just a couple incidental bites. It's usually places like the Congo where you're getting 1,000 bites from.
Yeah, and it's relatively low numbers of transmissions where we're at in West Africa.
Exactly. But it's still not fun to get bit by flies.
I know.
They're not fun. It's like horse flies. You don't want to get bit.
I know. I hate them. so yeah, we got out of there and we went over to the river.
Relatively unscathed too.
I had a couple bites. So anyways, we got out of there, went to the river where, Abrima had arranged for us to take a boat ride on a flat bottom metal boat that would cruise up and down the river. So we got about 2 miles or so, and there was a spur up a tributary that we went up and had 4 species of kingfishers. We had malachites, gray-headed, pied, woodland, African fish eagle, and then our bird that I hadn't really expected. I mean, he kind of offhandedly mentioned at the beginning of the trip, like, we might see African finfoot, but this was the place to see it.
Yeah, and boom, a male popped out. We got tons and tons of photos, and I don't know if we got any videos of it going along. But
no, not good ones.
Yeah, but it was just like tons of photos of this finfoot. Really, really good looks. Easy good looks that we weren't like struggling to try to find. So it was definitely much better than when we were in Uganda, that it was kind of looking at this looking underneath the bushes to this one little bird that's kind of hiding. Like, this guy was out in the open, kind of swimming along.
Yeah, so we went back to the lodge for lunch and just kind of cooled off and everything. And then the evening, Abrima wanted to take us to the Bansung Quarry, which is actually the village that he was from.
Yeah, this is his hometown that we're in.
Yeah, which is cool to see that. And there's a quarry there, which is a fantastic place to watch red-throated bee-eaters come into roost. And there's...
It's like the first known roosting site in Gambia. That people have found, and it happened to be in his home village, and tons of them. The whole side of the quarry is pockmarked all the way across. It looks like a sapsucker tree, all the way across of holes that just tons and tons and tons of bee eaters, hundreds of bee eaters.
Yeah, and that place was it was absolutely magnificent. Abrima was telling us about how disappointed he was, though, that the site itself, like, it was owned by the village, and it was just, a quarry, and then it was kind of abandoned after that. And then recently it seemed that the village elders had sold the property to someone, but he wasn't entirely sure who and what they were going to do with it, because they had built a wall alongside of it that was relatively new. And so he was, just... really upset about that, because the development there could potentially ruin that roost for the red-throated bee eaters. Mm-hmm. So that was really interesting to learn, and just, a shame. I hope that doesn't end up happening.
Yeah, hopefully that location doesn't get destroyed, because it's a really good birding location, and there is a quarry they moved the quarrying over because the visiting guides convinced the village elders to stop mining out of this quarry and move over like a quarter mile and start mining out of another spot. And so then they successfully did that. They cleaned up the garbage that was there. And then the village elders, for whatever reason, they decided to sell it. And now it's being developed, not very quickly, but it's being developed into something that probably... may or may not be good for the birds.
Yeah, so after we watched the bee eaters do their thing, the sun started to set, and we were just kind of hanging around. And it's like, what are we here for? And it was the four-banded sand grouse that would come into the water just after sunset. Mm-hmm. There was about 36 of them is what we counted. And that was absolutely incredible. I got some photos and videos of it, of them all coming in and hanging out in the water.
A lot of audio of them flying in, because they were just like, it was nonstop, like just flying in, as they're coming in. And we're like, oh, well, maybe if we walk over to this side, over this direction, because it looked like there was a little pond that we couldn't see very well. Mm-hmm. So we moved over to this other direction, and then all of a sudden nightjars start flying over.
Yeah.
And we had lots of long-tailed nightjars, and then all of a sudden standard wing nightjars.
I know.
And it's like, what? These are just... And this is just fascinating. These nightjars, the long winged nightjars, the long tailed nightjars, the standard winged nightjars. Like, by this point, we have basically all the nightjars.
We did have all the nightjars that were
expected, and it was just like, this is mind boggling. It's so cool. And our Abrima, our guide, was super excited about the nightjars. Like, you could tell he was really excited about the nightjars, because he must have never stayed long enough for the nightjars.
Yeah.
Because we were really interested in the sand grouse. So we were taking photos and getting audio and stuff of the sand grouse. And so I think we were staying longer than he normally stays. And then all of a sudden the nightjars start coming in and flying around us.
Yeah.
Really cool.
So yeah, next day we got up to look for carmine bee eaters, which we ended up seeing that were pretty cool. And on our way to the next spot, to the lodge for that evening, we had a whole group of white helmet shrike fly in, which they're a lot like jays, like blue jays. Mm-hmm. They kind of hang around in groups, and they move from, from trees together.
Yeah, and they're really curious. They want to know what's going on with people. Mm-hmm. So they came down, wanted to see us and see what we're doing standing on the side of the road before they decided, oh, you guys are fine. And then they flew away. But as a group, as a family group, they come down to investigate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as we were working our way west across the south bank, we ended up staying at two more lodges, one of which was brand new, didn't have anything. We tried for Pell's Eagle Owl there, or Pell's Fishing Owl there.
That's the Sanquia Riverside Lodge.
Yes, Sanquia Riverside Lodge. No luck on the owl.
We had a fisherman that like, in his off time, he just paddled us up and down the river. And
and
he
worked his butt off.
He did. That man really put in his effort.
Absolutely. And so no real birding luck there. A couple just random species to add to the trip, but no lifers or anything. So he kept moving, got to Tendaba Lodge, which Tendaba Lodge is it's a pretty well-known lodge by Europeans. It's right on the river.
It's huge.
It's a big, huge lodge. It's massive. There's hundreds of cabins at this place. It has a hide that's within walking distance. A long walk, but within walking distance of the lodge that
Senegambia
Tours has rebuilt it. The village initially built it, and then they've rebuilt it. It's up at the school.
Yeah.
Great birds there. Great place to go at sunset. Red-winged pitelia, all sorts of starlings. I think five canaries. Species of starlings. Canaries. Just all sorts of really cool stuff.
Yeah.
The next morning, we went at Tendaba. We went out to see a bunch of cormorants, and when we came back from the cormorant colony, massive cormorant colony, Abrima was like, you know what? We were going to do two nights here at Tendaba, but we've basically seen the targets. Let's go to another lodge that I know, Marikisa Camping Lodge.
River Camp.
Marikisa River Camp. It's pretty close to Banjul. But there's some really cool stuff that direction. So we're like, yeah, let's do that. So we hit the road, packed our stuff, hit the road, and got to Marikisa River Camp. And it's a really interesting place. There's a Dutch man came down. To Gambia,
70s or 80s,
and decided I don't want to leave. So he bought this piece of property on the river, started this river camp that's basically just a bunch of cabins with no electricity, but nice beds, water in the rooms. So you have showers and sinks and stuff, toilets, but no electricity in each of the cabins. You got to charge up in the main lodge area.
Yeah.
And really good birds, giant kingfisher, and
that was amazing. That was, it just fishes right from the lodge.
Yeah, and she knows she knows all the crocodiles by name, so she goes out and feeds them every morning.
And I gotta say, that was like some of the best food we had was there.
Such
like,
good food. Yeah.
Dinner was fantastic, and then breakfast. I mean, of course, it's just a baguette, which I'm never gonna argue about having a baguette for breakfast. But they had like fresh pressed peanut butter and like locally sourced honey and like jam that she had made. Like that place is incredible. I would definitely go back. And Jute and Adima were just like the nicest people.
So nice. Yeah. So definitely recommend Marikisa River Camp as a place to go. If you're going that direction, don't skip that stop. That's a good stop.
Yeah. So, that was fun getting the giant kingfisher. We spent a lot of time taking videos and things of that. And then our last day we were headed into Banjul, and we had a couple spots along the way to stop there, of course. The first one was to Pirang Forest National Park, and that was where we just stopped, and there was a northern white-faced owl right alongside the... So that was great to see that owl. And then there was another forest just right near there, the Farsuda Forest Community Nature Reserve, which is so cool because the communities, you know, get together and have these sites, which I always think is really neat. And that was where we got the grayish eagle owl, which they were a lot like long-eared owls, I felt like.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely
they look like them.
It looks like them, and it kind of acts like them in terms of hanging in a group,
like
roosting
have those
in a group.
Diurnal roosts together that, you know, is where it's going to be and everything. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to see that one. But we wandered around that forest down by the wetland area because there was potentially a white-backed night heron.
Mm-hmm.
And that bird really threw us for a loop, too, because, like, at first there was a local guide from the forest that went along with us.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, had an idea of where it was, and he saw it. And then no more. Like, we didn't see it. Abrima didn't see it. And so he went kind of along the back of where the wetlands were onto the other bank and tried to like rustle it up a little bit. And eventually I did see it, but I couldn't tell you where it was. So I had to put the scope on it. It was like, just look into the scope and you'll see its eye.
But it was really interesting because the guide walked around to the backside, like with the intention of like, oh, well, I'll see if I can get it to flush a little bit. And he didn't even get close to it. He was still a good 100 feet away.
Yeah.
And it didn't flush or anything. Hannah just happened to finally see it, and then Abrina yelled to the guy, "Hey, stop, don't move."
Yeah.
And then the guy was just, the guy had no idea where he was at or where the bird was at. And he's just like standing in the forest like, okay, I'm not moving. Just waiting. And we're looking at a bird that's not even close to where the guide is, but we just didn't want him to move just in case him getting closer did flush it and then made it disappear.
Yeah. So that after seeing that, and there's a great water and feeding station right there too, Abrima took us to his house where his wife cooked us dinner, or cooked us lunch, and mm-hmm. met his kids. So that was really fun to do that, and also
see behind the curtain.
Yeah, and also her food is amazing.
Oh my gosh, it was good.
Yeah. And then he took us to our hotel that we had booked that for our last night in Gambia, which was the Bungalow Beach Hotel right next to Kotu Bridge, which Kotu Bridge is a huge birding spot. That's where a bunch of guides like hang out, and they lead tours around that local area, but you can also find a guide there to
take
hire
you other places, or you can also hire him for a boat ride right out of the bridge. Yeah. And there's lots of options right there. So if you don't have any plans for the first day or the last day or any time during your trip when you go to the Gambia, staying near the Kotu Bridge is a good place to go, because there's just a lot of guides and a lot of bird activity going on right in that area.
Yeah. So we got all settled in the hotel and then met Abrima at the Kotu Bridge birding station, and he was trying to get us our last bird because we had 99 lifers for the trip. He was trying to find us that 100 bird. So walked all around that area, tried for painted snipe with no luck, got eaten to death by mosquitoes looking for it. So then he was
the
like,
the only time we got attacked by mosquitoes, and it's the last day that we're there.
And he was like, hop in the car, we're gonna go look for something. And I was like looking through the target species for that area and like, well, we need this. And
But Abrima was like, no, painted snipe is going to be the easiest. I know we can get painted snipe. We are going to do it. We need painted snipe. And so it was like, we stopped at like three or four spots, and he's like, it was just side of the highway, and he's like, oh, here's a wetland. He hops out and he goes running through the wetland looking. He's like, okay, nothing. All right. Hops back in the car. We're just driving. Every single time there's a wet spot on the side of the road, he hops out and he goes and runs, and he's like, oh, we got to find it. We're running out of daylight. Got to find it. He was so desperate to get us that the hundredth lifer. And we're just going and going and going. And then as we're driving, I think we had one more stop left. One more attempt left. Or maybe we had five more. I don't know. But we had one more attempt left. And we're driving through an area that's a big open salt marsh. And I see a whole bunch of terns mm-hmm. roosting.
And one of the birds I just said we hadn't seen yet was an African crested tern.
And I knew it. And I knew the difference between that and a royal tern. And I'm looking and I'm like, I think I see something that doesn't look right. Can you, and I'll, or not a royal tern, a Caspian tern, sorry. And I was like, there's a tern out there. Abrima, you got to look at this. And he wasn't really that interested. He was more interested in like, we got to find a painted snipe. But I was like, no, I swear this is a different tern.
Yeah.
And it was an African crested tern. It was one African crested tern hanging out with a group of Caspian terns just in the middle of this big, big flat area. And I was like, that's it. That's number 100, and the relief was palpable from Abrima. Like, he was just like, oh. Like he was like, okay, we're, and like, it was very clear. He was like, I've done it. I did it. We made it to 100. I don't have to feel bad.
Yeah. So he took us back to the hotel. I realized that I had 99 species and Eric had 100.
But we didn't want to say anything because Abrima was so relieved at getting 100.
Yeah, so I wasn't going to make a big deal about it. Like, what's it matter? Who cares? So anyways, said goodbye to him. Next day, we had a couple hours before catching our plane. So we walked down to the Kotu Bridge and birded a little bit. There's a vulture feeding station mm-hmm. there. So we watched that for a little while.
Yeah, 10 o'clock in the morning, they feed the vultures every day.
Yeah, black kites and hooded vultures come in. And my 100th bird was right in that area too, which is a white-capped robin chat.
White-capped robin chat.
There we go. Boom. 100 lifers on that trip. Walked around the tourist shops a little bit. We walked on the beach. The beach there is fantastic. It's beautiful. Gosh. It's warm. You know, we saw some really cool sand dollars that have like these crazy teeth in the bottom of
them.
Looks
like you use them as a saw, maybe.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, they would break instantly, but whatever. We had lunch at the hotel, packed our bags, and took the taxi to the airport.
Yeah. Had a little bit of complications getting out.
I think we might have mentioned it in the last episode, but you have to pay a fee to leave, and we didn't have enough money in
the same denomination.
Yeah, in one denomination. So that was kind of frustrating.
Yeah. We we were just a couple of
Delossie
short and also a couple of pounds short. Either way, I could split the difference, but they wouldn't take split. So it was, and the power went out a couple of times while we were doing it. So it became a really stressful time for just a few minutes. But then once we got past that security getting in there, then everything calmed down. Got our boarding passes and got on our plane and came home.
Yep.
After spending 2 weeks in the Gambia and Senegal.
In West Africa.
West African birds.
Yeah, so we got 100 lifers on that trip and mm-hmm. 200 in Senegal and then like 222 in the Gambia.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a week in either of those destinations can warrant you a lot of species.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was a total of about 300 species.
Something like, yeah.
With the mix of the two there. But it was a good trip overall. I would recommend if you happen to be going to West Africa, that's a good location to go to. If you're from Europe, it's a much easier trip. It's yeah. just a nonstop flight straight down, and definitely a great introduction. If you're coming from Europe, a great introduction to Africa of easy to travel in terms of security and ease of getting to birds. Easy to do. If you're not really relatively inexpensive for a European to get there. And then also the cost of lodges and foods and stuff like that is relatively cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And pretty good food too.
Yeah.
Like
simple food, but good.
Yeah. But like we said in our last episode, our travel doctor is mm-hmm. like, you don't go to Africa for the food, but I mean, we had really good food.
Yeah. It wasn't bad. There was no bad food. It wasn't like crazy spicy or super flavorful, but it was good.
I was going to say that
there was some spicy stuff.
Some of what we had was really flavorful.
In Senegal, there was some spicy stuff.
I mean, you really want the that chicken. I mean, I feel like...
The chicken yassa?
Yeah. Yeah. You're craving that chicken yassa.
I could go for some chicken yassa.
Yeah. I could go for a good baguette.
Well, anyways, thank you guys all for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it and or learned something new. Please, please, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Music, or anywhere else you listen to us. If you'd like to connect with us on the socials, you can follow us at Hannah Goes Birding and Eric Goes Birding on Instagram, at We Go Birding on Twitter, Hannah and Eric Go Birding on TikTok. Follow our Facebook page, Hannah and Eric Go Birding. Email us, hannahandericgobirding@gmail.com, or our website, www.gobirdingpodcast.com. Tell us what you like, tell us what you hated, and share us with your friends.